Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Sayantanam svastanam va na sangrinita bhikshuka makshika eva sangrina sahatena vinasyati Sayantanam svastanam va nasangrinita bhikshuka makshika eva sangrina sahatena vinasyati Sayantanam
meant for the night.
Svastanam,
meant for tomorrow.
Va,
either.
Na,
not.
Sangrinita,
should accept.
Bhikshuka,
a saintly mendicant.
Makshika,
honeybee.
Eva,
like.
Sangrinan,
collecting.
Saha,
with.
Tena,
that collection.
Vinashyati,
is destroyed.
Translation,
a saintly mendicant should not even collect foodstuffs to eat later in the same day or the next day. If he disregards this injunction and, like the honeybee, collects more and more delicious foodstuffs, that which he has collected will indeed ruin him. Purport, Brahmara refers to that honeybee who wanders about from flower to flower, and Makshika is the honeybee who accumulates more and more honey in the beehive with great attachment. A saintly mendicant should be like the Brahmara bee, because if he imitates the Makshika bee, his spiritual consciousness will be ruined. This point is so important that it is repeated in this verse. So the point here that is being stressed in these verses is that a saintly person, a saintly mendicant, or a devotee who is in the renounced order of life, he should depend on Krishna. These rules and regulations that we find for the mendicants or the sannyasis is to make them more dependent on the Lord. That's the purpose of Varnashram Dharma, Daivi Varnashram Dharma. Whatever the rules and regulations are for each of the different Varnas and Ashramas, their goal is to make everyone more and more Krishna conscious. And of course, in Vedic society, these rules were strictly followed. But it means that all the different orders followed them. So generally, therefore, the mendicants could be assured that the householders would give them Nowadays, if someone is just going, you know, begging, if there would be many, say, such mendicants in the society, in a present society, people would not support them, I think, in a modern Western society. They would be chastised severely or, you know, locked up. As a nuisance, public nuisance. or most likely what is happening, the government will be paying them dole money. They can draw the dole. But that's not going to help them depend more on Krishna. Generally speaking, that would help them, you know, become lazy. They're supposed to move around, not just for, you know, filling their belly or collecting food stuff. They're supposed to move around because they're supposed to preach. They're supposed to give transcendental knowledge to people in general. And in exchange, they will get some, you know, donation to something to maintain themselves, maintain the body somehow or other. This is the idea. To encourage them not to kind of hole up in one place and hoard, you know, all kinds of paraphernalia and, you know, food and Lakshmi. And then what will they do? They just enjoy it and enjoy the senses. Then what is there to do? They don't have any family members that they have to support. So if Visadhu is just going to, sannyasi, sit down in one place and get money from the government and, you know, get this and that and just accumulate, then he won't progress in spiritual life. Most probably he'll he'll become weaker and weaker, and the tendency of their mind and senses is to try and enjoy, so he'll fall down to a platform of material enjoyment. So, you know, these rules and regulations which restrict him from hoarding and over-collecting are meant to keep him dependent on Krishna, to keep him lean and mean, not mean, but lean and enthusiastic and on the spiritual platform as much as possible, to reduce his bodily necessities, so that, you know, he's thinking less and less that I'm the body, and he's thinking more and more on spirit, soul, and depending on Krishna and chanting the holy names and hearing about Krishna. His time then will be spent more in those spiritual activities, and because he has to move around to collect, then he'll share that spiritual knowledge with the others, especially with the householders who have the tendency, you know, to become overly absorbed in the household affairs. The tendency in household life there is to give so much importance to all these family affairs as if it were the be-all and end-all of existence, and no time for anything else, and you have to accumulate as much as possible. You have to get a nice house and build a bank balance for security, and you have to provide for the future, you know, save up for the future of our children and see they're well educated, and send them, if, you know, people nowadays living in India, or send them to America, send them to Australia, get them to the West, some, you know, foothold in the West, and, you know, they'll send more money to the family. So this is, this is the thinking. And just becoming overly absorbed in family life. For grihasthas also, I mean, there are various rules and regulations. It's permitted, of course, to accumulate some property and, you know, keep some reserve for emergency and so forth. But the householders, they have to think of the welfare of the mendicants also. Is not that that's important for them to be giving, to be generous, giving to the mendicants and helping the brahmacharis and sannyasis, so that they don't become too miserly, you know, just focused on their own self and family members, and just, you know, constant meditation on their own family, because it creates a kind of consciousness, you know, if all householders get that kind of consciousness, then they become very, you know, their relationships can become very conflicting because they're, you know, struggling with one another to accumulate as much as possible, and they'll just ignore the sadhus and the sannyasis, and, you know, they'll, or at least they'll put that, you know, this is a very secondary matter, or, you know, it's last importance, if at all. That's how things go. But generally, they should give first importance to respecting the sadhus, to supporting them, donating, even if it means one's family has to live a little bit more austerely. Those who are very exemplary householders, you know, they certainly they'll take care of their family, and they'll, you know, provide some suitable arrangement. But still, they'll give the main importance to devotional service, and they'll give great importance to supporting the sadhus and mendicants. And in this way, they can participate in the spreading of Krishna consciousness just by supporting the sadhus. Of course, it is recommended for householders also to preach Krishna consciousness, and it's a very good platform from which to preach. It's good there are sannyasi preachers, brahmachari preachers, householder preachers, different kinds of persons preaching from different walks of life, because from different ashramas, because that shows different kinds of people how you can practice Krishna consciousness in all situations. And since most people are householders, they'll want to know how is it possible for a householder to advance in spiritual life. A householder may see the sannyasis are practicing, they're preaching. Very nice, we can give them donations. But how do we, you know, what's the example for us? We cannot become sannyasis just like that. Maybe in the, you know, old age we become sannyasis, but in a midst of, you know, family life with many dependents, how will a person, you know, suddenly leave and become a sannyasi? Very difficult. His mind become troubled if he tries to do it, and he may go back to his family. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was not keen on that, just like Kurma Brahmana. He was a householder, he was struggling in a family life, and when Mahaprabhu passed through his village, he wanted to go with him, get free from the misery of family life. But Mahaprabhu said, no, stay here, don't speak like that again, he said. You stay with your family, but you chant Hare Krishna, and in this way you will not be troubled by the miseries of material existence. And furthermore, he said, whoever you meet, tell him about Krishna, and in this way become guru and deliver the whole country. He told him to become guru, even though he was a householder struggling in his situation. He wasn't a big, you know, sadhu or sannyasi. He was a simple person, but still Mahaprabhu gave him that instruction. So that instruction then, to become guru and deliver the country, that is for all. People can preach. Guru means teacher, spiritual teacher. Even in India, of course, even the teacher in the high school or the primary school is a guru also, called guru. So, real guru, though, that's being referred to here, is one who is disseminating spiritual knowledge, and one can do that from a householder ashram also, and it's important that the householders do it. And we see it's very effective when householders preach, and when they have Namahata programs, Bhakti Viksha programs, they call other householders, and they, you know, they can associate together. They have similar situations, similar, you know, concerns, and in this way they can see, householders can see how an exemplary householder is practicing. So then he's able to understand that I can also do this. In our family we can also do. So in this way he will encourage his own family members to practice Krishna consciousness. Actually, in the beginning of the Sankirtan movement in Navadvip, you can see mostly householders, they were holding kirtan in the homes, like Srivas Pandit. Huh? There would be nocturnal kirtan in his home, ecstatic kirtan. In fact, even once during the kirtan, so ecstatic that actually Srivas Pandit's son died. And of course the women were, you know, they knew about that and they were naturally bereaved. They were crying. But Srivas, he didn't stop the kirtan. He didn't tell Mahaprabhu. He didn't want to disturb Mahaprabhu's ecstasy with his family affairs. After the kirtan, the Mahaprabhu found out. And he said, "Why you did not tell me?" And Shiva said, "I didn't want to disturb you." And then Mahaprabhu touched the boy. He came back to life. And then he spoke some philosophical words. And then he said, "My time is finished here." And he departed. But we can see anyway that kirtan was being held in the householders' homes. They were encouraging one another to practice Krishna consciousness. So this is recommended. Householders shouldn't just accumulate and, you know, live in a cocoon, wrap a cocoon of all kinds of material assets around themselves and then sit and worry about it all the time and have no time for spiritual life. It's enjoined that householders should have spiritual practices. They should worship the deity, chant the holy names. They should distribute prasadam. They should have some kind of preaching activities, or they should support those who are engaged in preaching activities. And definitely they should support the saintly persons and mendicants. And so the sadhus would know that they can be assured when moving here and there that people will help them and give them some support. Just like nowadays in Buddhist countries like Burma, for example, the monks go out begging in the morning, and it's obligatory for the householder. The householder would be standing at their doors or at the gates, and they'll be, you know, usually the monks, they're passing there in a long line. Sometime you'll see long line, hundreds of monks, starting from the very senior most in the front, and then you see the, you know, size of the monks, smaller and smaller at the back, that's very small monk, you know, 4 or 5 year old monk, 6 year old monk with his small bowl. And the householders are giving every monk, you know, something. Of course, unfortunately, it's not all vegetarian. Although there are certain monasteries which, you know, only eat vegetarian, but only accept vegetarian alms. But this is very rare. Most of them are not following properly in that regard. But that's all right. I mean, they at least they can be assured that you know, people will support them. The government is also encouraging it. It is generally considered a matter of, you know, responsibility, householders' responsibility in that society. They have to do it somehow or other. The monks have to be supported. But generally, those monks, they're just going in a line and they're just begging, and, you know, no preaching going on. Of course, when they go back to their temple, they do have their, you know, prayers and so forth. And when people come to the temple, they can hear the discourses that they give. But that might not happen every day, you know. It happen once a week or something, or on some special day. But still, you know, they have powerful influence in the society, there's no question. In the temples there also, they're very nicely maintained. Burma is not a rich country by sort of modern standards, mainly due to the government, military government, which has been very, very repressive. And in fact, was it last year or a year before? There was a huge uprising by the monks against the government. With hundreds of thousands of monks in the streets protesting the government. You know, I think they shot a few and imprisoned some. And very ruthless government. 1988 also. It was 2008, I think, last year. It was 20-year anniversary of the previous. There was a previous big, you know, uprising against it. A peaceful uprising, you know, peaceful protest. In 1988, they also repressed very brutally. We couldn't go to the country for 5 years after that. But this time, they've glossed it over pretty fast, and was a bit restriction for a few months, but now we can get back in there. But their temple, there's so many pagodas and temples. They're all covered in gold leaf. You know, this is a land of millions of such, hundreds of thousands of millions of such temples and pagodas. So there is that consciousness in society. And well, it's Buddhist, but you know, still. That tradition of giving to the monks, supporting the monks, taking care of the temple, that the householders have to be humble in front of the monks, it's very strong. In fact, it's much more strong than in India. Nowadays in India, you know, things are very topsy-turvy, and there's so many different influences, and you know, so many different sects, and and generally speaking, the government has been pushing secularism very strongly. So therefore, they don't have that tradition. Even Prabhupada, he would complain that, you know, in Muslim countries, they have to read the Quran in school. But he said in our schools, you know, they don't teach Bhagavad Gita. Government, you know, it's trying to please everybody so they get the votes. They want the Muslim vote, so they have to keep some, you know, kind of so-called neutral policy. Therefore, no religious teaching in the school. So Prabhupada was very critical. He said, you know, they should teach it. Okay, let them have for the Muslim, even, you know, let them teach the Hindu children Bhagavad Gita, and let them teach the Muslims Quran, and if there's some Christian, let them teach the Bible. You know, they should get some kind of education in spiritual knowledge. Otherwise, the whole country becomes very materialistic. Prabhupada, as we know, was a follower of Gandhi in his youth, and Gandhi was, you know, he was certainly a very patriotic person, but he was very Vedic in that he really encouraged following a Vedic culture and living simply and, you know, village life. And he also, you know, spoke from the Bhagavad Gita, even though he didn't have a, you know, completely proper understanding of Bhagavad Gita. But he was more stressing on, you know, that part of Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says, you know, you should do your duty, but you don't have a right to enjoy the fruits, results of your work. You should work selflessly. So, you know, the politician will use that part of the Gita, you know, to encourage people just to work. And you see sometimes on India, in buses, adverts like, work is worship, things like that. Work is worship. Well, in Krishna consciousness, I mean, service to Krishna, that is worshipping Krishna. Bhaja, Prabhupada said the word bhaja, we use the bhajan or The word bhaja means to worship. And Prabhupada said it doesn't just mean work, you know, doing some ritual, but it means actually serving, working for Krishna. That's included. Glorification, ritual, and service also is all included. So this stress was given by Gandhi, and Prabhupada was his follower, but of course when he met Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he became convinced that here was a real sadhu, and he became his follower. He said in the first meeting he didn't officially accept him, but within the heart he said, I accepted him as my spiritual master. This interesting excerpt on the Prabhupada DVDs, Bhagwat Das, he is in Mumbai. It's a portion of the DVDs where Prabhupada walks on the beach in Mumbai in 74, I think. And Bhagwat Das, and it also shows excerpts of Prabhupada on the roof in the of his the apartment building where his flat was. Nowadays those apartments are all knocked down in Juhu, but when we purchased the land, I think there were 1, 2, 3, 4, at least 4 apartment buildings there, and of course they were all occupied in the beginning. The front of the land was empty, and the back portion of the land had these 4, maybe 5 or 6, I can't remember exactly, apartment buildings, all full of, you know, different families. So, the laws in India are such that the landlord just can't, they just can't get rid of the tenants. Even when their lease is finished, the tenants that go on staying there, and you can't do anything. You have to pay a lot of money to get them to move out of their apartment. So that's why when we hear of the beginning of Hare Krishna land, it was very austere. The devotees were living in some sort of, you know, just kind of tent-like structures, and there were many mosquitoes and things. And we hear about that, and that's because they couldn't occupy the apartment. So then they built an extra floor on at least, I think, 3 apartment buildings. They had 3 or 4. They built an extra floor. So one of those Prabhupada, or maybe I can't remember actually. I remember we were for when I went there in 75, where we lived, the Brahmacharis lived, and where the offices were. That was on, you know, the upper floor of one of the apartment buildings. Ladies also had a upper floor of one of them. Prabhupada, I can't remember whether his was an extra floor or whether they had actually acquired couple of apartments. Maybe they had built extra on top for him also. But anyway, his apartment was on the top floor of one of those buildings, and then he would have darshan in his room from 4 to 6 every day, and then he would go up on the roof and continue the darshan, and it would go on till 8 or 9 often. So you know, devotees had a lot of access to Prabhupada in India, especially there in Juhu. They could go on the morning walks on the beaches, then they could go in the afternoon darshan and stay in the evening darshan, and so very wonderful. And Bhagwat Das was relating how once Prabhupada was, and he was talking to him alone, and Prabhupada was saying how Gandhi, you know, he had very good vision, and he wanted to make every village self-sufficient, and, you know, he was encouraging a cottage industry and living simply and maintaining the Vedic culture. He said, but Nehru and, what is it, Sardar Patel, is that his name? He was one of the big... Vallabhai Patel. He was what? He's also called Sardar Patel. Is it? Sardar Patel. Is he the same person? Or
same.
Mm-hmm. He was one of the big leaders at the time. Huh? So he said they followed the British plan of industrialization. Nehru, you know, he was fighting for independence of India, but actually he was educated in the UK, I think Oxford. And he was a very atheistic person, actually. He had no respect, hardly, for Vedic culture. You know, he said, when I die, I want that my ashes be put in this Triveni Sangam at Prayag, Allahabad. He said, this has no religious significance whatsoever, he said. None, he said. Simply, I like the place. Might even have been born there, I don't know. Was he born in Allahabad? Yeah, so anyway. Attachment to one's bliss of birth. So, you know, even though he was fighting, he was actually very westernized, and he took India on that path of industrialization. So Prabhupada was certainly very disappointed, but you know, he appreciated that Gandhi had the right vision in that sense. And Prabhupada said to Bhagavad, he said, I loved Gandhi. But then Bhagavad said, the next day we were walking on a Juhu beach, and normally Prabhupada would walk a certain distance and then he'd turn around and, you know, come back again. And different men, you know, different respectable gentlemen would join in the walks, and often there would be lively debate. Sometimes it would get a bit too much, actually, because there was one Dr. Patel, he was always arguing and challenging, and at one point Prabhupada instituted that a devotee was just reading. You can see it on the DVD. I don't know if any of you have seen the DVD, but there's a devotee from England, his name is Mahadev, and he's walking behind Prabhupada, and he's a Krishna book, and he's reading the Krishna book as they're walking along. And the Prabhupada instituted that, you know, just to stop all these gentlemen from all their, you know, foolish arguments. You know, they would go on ranting on and on. They would argue very strongly with Prabhupada, sometimes, you know, to the point of offensiveness. And therefore the Prabhupada instituted that reading. But you know, when they would join the walk, Prabhupada would, you know, they would, you know, offer their namaskar, and Prabhupada would, you know, offer back like that. So Bhagavat said that one morning, the next morning, he said, we walked very, very far on the beach. And he said, I was on Prabhupada's left, I guess. And Prabhupada, you know, he offered, you know, his like pranam. And Bhagavat said, I thought that some gentleman had joined the group on the left side, but no one was there. But then when I looked up, I saw, you know, in the garden of one house, there was like a gazebo, and under was a statue of Gandhi. So he said, Prabhupada walked so far along the beach, you know, just to offer his respects to Gandhi. And then they turned around coming back, and Prabhupada began criticizing Gandhi. How he had, you know, he hadn't understood the Bhagavad Gita properly, and he hadn't preached it properly, and so forth. As we know, Prabhupada wrote to Gandhi after they got independence, and he said, you know, now you've accomplished your goals. Politically, you should preach Bhagavad Gita, he said, but he never replied. So like that, often, you know, we do hear, you know, Prabhupada will criticize Gandhi, but like the word, use of the word Mahatma, you know, in the Bhagavad Gita there, Mahatmanas tu mam partha daivim prakritim ashuta, and there in that verse, and Prabhupada says that, you know, one cannot, you know, make an ordinary person a Mahatma just by, you know, putting some label on him like that. He didn't appreciate that the word Mahatma was used for a political leader. He would say that a Mahatma, a real Mahatma, is a devotee,
Mahatma means devotees, a great soul, not just some political leader. But anyway, Gandhi, as we know, it said he was a saint among the politicians. But among the politicians, he was a saint. but among saints, he was a politician. That's how Prabhupada put it. but anyway, we see he had that affection and he appreciated the desire of Gandhi to maintain the Vedic culture and to base India's development on progress on that. Prabhupada himself, you know, in his preaching, he stresses that also, you know, having that we should have rural communities, devotees should live simply, etc., as well as having, you know, preaching in the cities. Also, I recall one incident when I was in Hyderabad in 76. Prabhupada went there to install the deities on Janmashtami, open the temple. We didn't actually go to that. We were on the library party, so our party was based in Calcutta, and we had to go down to that, to Andhra Pradesh, for distribution of sets of books, and we had to go to Hyderabad. But you know, the mood in ISKCON in those days wasn't that, you know, you just rush off to the big festivals and enjoy in the presence of Srila Prabhupada. So even though we had to go to Hyderabad and Prabhupada was going there, it was a big event, we had to distribute books on the way. And we spent Janmashtami in Bhubaneswar with Gaur Govinda Maharaj on the way. We had to stop to distribute some books there. And those days, Bhubaneswar, we had just got the land and there were only two mud huts there on the property. So Gaur Govinda Maharaj was staying in one. And when Prabhupada came, Prabhupada stayed in that one, and Gaur Govinda Maharaj stayed in the other one. The other one was generally, you know, used for brahmacharis or guests. And so we very humble arrangement on the land, a small pandal for Janmashtami. We couldn't go to Hyderabad. We didn't, you know, we weren't even thinking that, you know, we have to get there in time. There was no question. Those days in India, you weren't allowed to fly in planes, and you weren't allowed to make long distance phone calls. It was very simple and strict. Anyway, we reached Hyderabad, and Prabhupada was still there, and we got the chance to go in his room. He would inquire about the distribution of books. He was very interested in that. How many sets of books were being distributed? How many reviews? We would get reviews from scholars about his books, and Prabhupada would like us to read them out to him so he would know what the scholars said about his books. Anyhow, one of the evenings he was preaching to some Indian gentleman there. I was in the room, and Hari Sori was Prabhupada's servant at the time. And Prabhupada was preaching to them. He said, Gandhi, he spent so much of his blood to drive the British out of India. He said, but now you see the same Britishers, they're serving me. This one is distributing my books. He was pointed at me. This one is giving me massage. He pointed at Hari Sori. She said, who is better, Gandhi or me? So certainly, you know, Prabhupada had definitely had great affection for Gandhi, but you know, he felt that he was a bit disgusted actually with the outcome. Well, that there was division of India into, you know, Pakistan and India. Actually, Gandhi didn't want that, but the others were pushing hard for independence, and they thought better strike some deal.
Jinnah.
Yeah, Jinnah, and not only Jinnah. I mean, Jinnah was pushing for independent Pakistan, but Nehru and Sardar Patel, you know, they, instead of waiting a bit, you know, because Jinnah died within a year of the creation of Pakistan, and before he died, he said, "My greatest mistake was that I, you know, created this country." Created Pakistan. This is my greatest mistake. So Jinnah was also, he was a Western educated, chain smoking, you know, atheistic type of a person. And after Pakistan was created, they didn't give him much respect, actually. He was pretty disgusted. And he said, you know, it was a great mistake. If they'd waited a bit longer, you know, they might have got the whole India as one country independent. But, you know, they were pushing, you know, for independence, and Gandhi was a bit, you know, he would have preferred to have the whole country united, but, and, you know, he always tried to make peace between Muslims and Hindus. When there would be riots, then he would go there and he would try to calm everybody down, isn't it? You know, Calcutta, Noakhali, I think it's now in Bangladesh, but in East Bengal there were big riots there, but Gandhi went there to try to pacify them. So Prabhupada was, you know, he wasn't pleased that they divided the country up like that, and of course it's been the source of so much tension and several wars, and nowadays it's a big anxiety. Pakistan has nuclear weapons and Taliban has become very strong, and coming closer and closer to, is it Islamabad? That's the capital of Pakistan. If the Taliban takes control, and you know, there's a big anxiety in the world. So the Prophet predicted that would be like, you know, like that. You know, even he said if there would be another world war, it could spark off, you know, due to conflict between India and Pakistan. So, you know, so he was definitely, you know, he appreciated Gandhi, and especially appreciated his stress on simple living, Vedic culture, and he wanted to see the same spread, Vedic culture, simple living, high thinking, but with focus on Krishna, because they didn't, you know, give that focus on spiritual life. They just, you know, stressed it more as some kind of social arrangement, therefore it wasn't successful. But if the spiritual content is retained, then people will be satisfied, they'll be inspired, they'll be enlivened, and they'll be able to live simply. But if they don't have, you know, spiritual life, they don't have spiritual satisfaction, then people are hankering for so many material facilities. And that's what's going on in the Western world. And now people have so many material facilities and no spiritual life. You can go to the mall, you can buy practically anything. The shops are all very, you know, fancy and flashy, and they have so many items from all over the world. But people don't have any spiritual life, so what's the value? You know, they waste the human form of life. They accumulate, and you know, every house, if you could go into any house, probably anywhere in Melbourne, would be so much junk in there that isn't required. The people have just been accumulating. They stick it in the attic, or stick it in the, you know, closet, and you know, people, you know, sometimes old people die. The house is just full of junk. You know. Junk and animals and dogs and cats. So this is a position, and no spiritual life, people look elsewhere for happiness and satisfaction. But where there is real spiritual life, then people can live very, very, very simply, very austerely. Not that they don't need any material necessities. Of course, we have material body, material. There are certain material necessities, but one should try to keep it simple, keep it to a minimum, so that one doesn't have to think about those things all the time, and one can give time for thinking about devotional service, for thinking about Krishna, for developing one's spiritual life and encouraging others to develop their spiritual life. So this is the idea in these verses. with the, you know, this, especially with the sadhus, the wandering mendicants, to keep them, keep their lives simple, stop them from accumulating and getting all worried about their possessions, but rather to keep them focused on Krishna consciousness so that they can preach Krishna consciousness to the other members of society. And in this way, you know, society keeps a proper focus. So even though there are going to be, you know, householder, there are going to be vaishyas and sudras and kshatriyas and people who are, you know, very busy with so many affairs, still there's a class of people who keep reminding the others about the importance of spiritual life. So that's the duty of the brahmanas and especially of the sannyasis, of the wandering mendicants. So, Hare Krishna. Any comment or question here? Yeah. What was? It was part of India. Well, there are different states. There's Punjab. Like Punjab, most of Punjab is in Pakistan now. Smaller parts in India, where mostly the Sikhs are living there, right? Sikhs and Hindus, of course. Yes, other provinces there. Sindh was another province or state, like province or state. It's in Pakistan province. In India, there's states, but I mean, there was Punjab, Sindh, and then they have Northwest Frontier Province. That's beside Afghanistan and Baluchistan, I think, is it? That's near Iran. And what was East Pakistan? That was East Bengal. Now it's Bangladesh. So it was just India. Even Burma was an autonomous region of India during the British period. Therefore, many Indians were there. Still are. Indians, Nepali, still are. Most of our devotees there are from. And there are many temples there as well. So quite a few temples have been given to ISKCON. In Bangladesh also, there were so many Hindu temples there. Bengal was 47% Hindu, 53% Muslim. Therefore, the British gave most of it to the Muslims when they divided it. They made it East Pakistan. Yeah, it's all part of India. That's all. I think so, yeah. I mean, he did feel that, Gandhi's ideas were good, you know, for helping to spread Krishna consciousness. That idea, you know, village living and, you know, becoming self-sufficient in the villages. Prabhupada liked it very much. So he definitely drew on certain inspiration from Gandhi in that respect. No minute, yeah. Talking about oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Is that right? That just started when he heard from Dr. Patel, you mean? Mm-hmm. Or some doctor there said it to him? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Huh. Oh, okay. The doctor said, that's what Prabhupada had. Prabhupada said that, or the doctor said that?
Prabhupada
said that. Uh-huh. But he heard from the doctor that he should have exercise, is it?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, you can take, well, Prabhupada said that, you know. Is there some Vedic thing you can take gold from a filthy place, or a wife from a wife if she's of good character from a low family? So yeah. Knowledge can be taken even from a fool, is it? If it's correct. If something correct, he says. Yeah?
Yeah, I've got one man on the street, and he said that he read Gandhi's translation of Bhagavad Gita. And he said, that was the worst book I've ever read. And I was totally disgusted. And he went on to be quite offensive.
He, Gandhi, translated Bhagavad Gita?
Yeah. Not translated, he was just not commentary, just was disgusted. I was a bit.
Oh, few verses, huh?
Yeah, but mostly related to non-violence.
Mm-hmm.
So he had read the part about when Arjuna was speaking to Krishna about he didn't want to fight, and then Krishna told Arjuna to fight, and then he hadn't explained the proper reason why Krishna was telling Arjuna to fight.
Mm-hmm.
So he got a complete misconception.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that respect, it seemed like Arjuna was telling service.
Well, yeah, from a strict Krishna conscious point of view, he didn't have the proper understanding. Otherwise, he would have been preaching devotional service, importance of devotional service. Just by, you know, having programs at their homes, and well, of course they can be encouraged by the other devotees who are not householders. They can encourage them, and they can see the examples of householders who are preaching and doing nicely by many ways, by hearing Prabhupada's instruction, by reading Prabhupada's books. Everyone should be encouraged, not only householders. Yeah.
You were talking about the Buddhist. We have Buddhist day coming up on Sunday, and sometimes we are asked, you know, what we think about Buddhism and what we think, like specifically about Dalai Lama.
Well, usually we say we respect the Dalai Lama, and we accept Buddha as an incarnation of Krishna. I mean, usually we may answer like that. There are many aspects of Buddhist philosophy and culture, of course, which have their roots in Vedic culture. They believe in reincarnation, karma, things like that. So, I think we should just stress on the common points and leave it at that.
Sometimes my frustration in our temples that when we're preaching, we seem to be attracting a lot more Indians to our community. And the Indians, they can't deal with the conception that Krishna is one of the gods, or that come from the Brahma family. Oh, down on the devotees. How can we do with this stuff? How do we treat this behavior?
I don't know. Is that very common? That Indian people are treating the Western devotees as lechas? Is it true? I didn't pick it up particularly. Anyway, we just have to go on preaching, you know, Krishna consciousness as Prabhupada presented it, not be too concerned about that. I mean, if Westerners are malicious, then why come to the West? You know, what are you here for, sort of thing? I don't think generally Indian people in the West, they don't, you know, I haven't encountered that. And if somebody would speak like that, I would answer them like that, you know. You know, if Westerners are malicious, why come here? And Prabhupada, you know, he came to the West, but he said, I have come to give, not to take. You know. Many Indian people are coming to West to make money, right? Because they feel easier to make money. So he said, I have come not to beg, but to give Krishna consciousness. So I think generally we should just preach Krishna consciousness and not be concerned. Okay, Hare Krishna, thank you. Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Gaura Premanandi.